Let's start today's topic. Today's topic is but how do I have a pointer? Do you see there in my mouse the online?
Yes.
Good. So I will use this. Everybody see that. Okay. Today's topic is a nanophotonics. So final part of my part. So we talk basically photonics in a nanoscale. So something to relate it to the light. Last time we talked electronics, and now we go to light and photonics. Okay, now. So introduction and some application, and then the real part is a plasmonics and maybe metamaterial. That's gray, depends on how we are in a time. And what is actually photonics? Well, everybody knows what is optics. There's some definitions written there. So optics is a branch of physics. It involves behavior, a property of light, and including interaction with matter. So this means that interaction with matter here means that basically, like in a mirror, you have interaction of a light. It reflects light. That kind of interaction is dealt with optics. And photonics, and there's a lot of instruments using optics, like a camera. Everybody has nowadays camera in their phone, so they have optics there. And what is a photonics then? It's basically same idea, but now it's more about a generation, detection, and manipulating through emission, transmission, and modulating. Meaning that the material is kind of taking energy from your light, so absorbing, and your light kind of disappears. Then it can be re-emitted. So you are kind of all the time creating photons and absorbing photons, more than just reflecting the light. So that is a basic difference. And in this case, you can much more easily do something like amplification and detection and sensing. But if it starts from scratch, I don't know how much optics you have dealt in your previous courses. So simplest case of geometrical optics is ray optics. This is kind of classical view that light comes, it's a ray, it goes directly, then it can reflect. And everybody knows Snell's law. So this is basically, if you have two materials, both are transparent and they have a refractive index. So this is how the light travels in a material. It's described by refractive index. And Snell's law is basically that the refractive index times the angle of incidence, which is here. And this is also something people always put the wrong way. So they put usually the angle between the surface. That's not the angle of incidence. Angle of incidence is the angle to the normal of a surface, meaning that if you have a zero angle, your light comes perpendicular, not like this. So basically, Snell's law just tells that your refractive index times the angle of incidence is the same. And in the other material, you have a different index times the angle of reflection in this case. Of course, light goes both ways, so it holds both ways. And this can be, for example, nicely modeled to make a lenses or any mirrors or anything like that. It always holds. But then, certainly everybody who has glasses knows that they nowadays have anti-reflective coating, or many other things also. Some mobile phones even can have an anti-reflective coating. And this is basically where the ray optics breaks down. This you cannot explain by ray optics. So it is something else. So usually you have a stack of films, very thin films. They can be like a tens of nanometers. So every visible light, what is a wavelength of visible light? Everybody knows. From 400 to 700 approximately. If you just say 550, that's a middle value, nice green color. And so they are much thinner than the wavelength of a light. And of course, in that case, this kind of ray model cannot work. So this ray works only if you have a system much higher than your wavelength. You have to go to much different. So if you think of this kind of light as a wave. So here is a basic idea of a diffraction and interference. So this is a kind of a classical ray model here. You have a light coming as a wave, and you have some opening, which is much bigger than your wavelength. In that case, it just goes through directly, and nothing basically happens. You see the shadow on a wall or wherever your light is going. So this part is bright, and the other parts here are dark. But if you have this hole much shorter than your wavelength, what happens basically is that this hole acts as a new source of light. And the light starts to travel every direction. So light comes here, and then it goes through this tiny hole, and which acts as a new source, and it goes every direction. And this is basically the idea for diffraction. And this happens for systems with smaller than the wavelength. And of course, the most most famous experiment, this is a Young's double slit experiment already at the very beginning of 1900. This is one of the famous experiments in the physics, where you have two slits and you see the interference pattern on your screen. And this is pretty easy to calculate. So let's put a couple of formulas to show that this is physics. And if we think these two slits, so they are here, in this picture, they are so small that you cannot draw them, but if you zoom in, you can see these two slits there. They both let through same intensity. So they're same width, similar, identical slits. But now, from these two slits, they travel to this point P, which has a coordinate Y from a zero angle. And since the other path is a little bit longer than the other one, they come in a different phase to the point P. So you can write a formula. So this is amplitude. Amplitude is directly, amplitude square is the intensity. So that's how you define the intensity. So you have a light coming from one slit. So it's a sine omega t. So it's oscillating as a function of time because it's a light. It's an oscillating wave. And then you have another light ray coming from another slit. It has exactly the similar wave, but now it has some phase change here. So it doesn't go at the same phase. And now you can do some manipulation for signs. As a high school style, you open this book of all formulas and you look, there's a nice sign formula. And you can write this in this form. So it's a cosine omega, the cosine of this phase difference divided by 2 times sine of this omega t plus, again, half of the phase difference. So this is just a basic manipulation of trigonometric functions. So, and now you look this formula. And how it looks, it has the same sine omega t which is again similar wave, but now it has also the half of the phase difference only, and amplitude is no more just A, but it's 2 times A and cosine, which depends cosine of this phase difference. So it depends on this phase difference, the amplitude. And now if you go to see the intensity of this double, so this total intensity, so coming from a two slits, so this is basically this. This is the amplitude, what you have. And intensity of then is just a square of that. And if you take square of that, there's a 4, and there's a A squared, which is the original intensity, times cosine squared of this phase. So it depends on the phase. Now, what is this phase difference? That's the biggest question now. If you think this picture, you can think that you have a, maybe this is actually something which I could draw maybe. Yeah, it should be somehow visible also in online. So this is your, now I'm standing in front of everybody. So this is your, and these are the light rays coming from two slits. And there you have an angle. So basically, if you think how much phase you get here, you can think it a wave here. At this distance, you would get 2 pi phase difference. So it starts going up, and then here it's the same position, it starts again going up. So you have a similar wave here than here. So this is your phase difference. So this would induce phase difference of a 2 pi, which is a full circle. Not degrees, but radians. And now if you think how much phase difference you get here, from this point to this point, you can write it as kind of a, it's a phase difference divided by full circle 2 pi. And if this gave you a 2 pi, then this is kind of a how long is this distance compared to the full wavelength. That gives you the fraction, how much phase difference you get. So it's a phase difference divided by 2 pi is the same than this delta r, which is the distance here divided by wavelength. And then you can just this delta r, you can just write as a sine of this theta. So it's a d times sine theta is a delta r, this additional distance you can see here. And then this you can also write, if you look the sine theta here, it's actually y divided by this distance, which we don't know exactly, except it's a L divided by cosine theta. So you can write it in this form. And now if you look the picture, the idea is that this angle is small. So let's look at the middle part, how it behaves. And then you can approximate this cosine actually as a 1. Cosine from any small angle is 1. If the angle is small enough. And then you can write this at very general formula. You just plug this now into this one, and you get the final intensity as a function of y. And as you can see, you get this kind of pattern. So you have a maximum at a 0, and then you have this kind of cosine square pattern where the maximum is actually 4 times the original intensity. So it's actually much more than you have 2 slits, both giving intensity I, but you get maximum 4. So they are really amplifying each other And then it continues like a regular spacing. So this is a usual interference pattern. I think everybody has seen that. What is the difference between the interference and diffraction? Does anybody know actually what is the difference? Many standard physical terms, these terms are somehow mixed sometimes. This is what interference, where you have a kind of light coming from two sources and they interfere with each other. And there's this kind of method also called X-ray diffraction, which Gerrit will tell you more. And I would call it X-ray interference, because you have a light coming from all atoms and they are interfering. But it's called X-ray diffraction. Maybe because such a light is originally due to diffraction. And diffraction means that you have only single slit, and still you see this kind of pattern. This happens with a small enough slits. And this case, you can basically think it as many sources next to each other on a slit, and then you do the interference thing. But since it's a continuous, it includes all kind of integration and so on, so we don't start calculating it now here. But the result is this, that you see one bigger maximum at the central, and then you see this kind of a small maximum outside. Something like this. Okay, I told just before that if you have a wavelength or slit much narrow than the wavelength, it acts as a source and you go everywhere. Now I take something else in the same situation. You have small slit and it doesn't go everywhere. If you make this slit small enough, what happens is that this central maximum, it just expands until it is everywhere. So if you take small enough slit, your light really goes everywhere behind it. But if it's just not small enough, little bit wider, comparable to wavelength, then you start to see diffraction pattern. And then basically in this double slit experiment, we considered ideal case. So we had two really narrow slits so that light really goes everywhere. And then we calculate the interference pattern. But in reality, usually these slits are not so narrow and you have a diffraction pattern from each of them. And then these are interfering. And what you get basically just the sum of these two patterns. So you get interference, you get a diffraction pattern from one slit like that, so maximum in the middle, and then the smaller maximums, and then you have two slits similar, so you have this interference pattern on top of the diffraction pattern. So this is the most common what you see. And the easiest way to see this at the home is just to take a laser pointer, take a CD, if anyone has CDs anymore, and point the laser to the CD and it reflects. CD has this kind of lines and they do exactly this kind of pattern on behind you, on a wall behind you. So that's the easiest way to make this kind of pattern. So this is kind of a semi-classical view of a light. Everything works nicely with ray optics until you go below wavelength, and then you start to have a diffraction, which we already talked that limits, for example, photolithography, since you wanted your narrow line, but then your light kind of expands to this kind of pattern, and then you don't get narrow line anymore. So, if you go to more microscopic theory, you get familiar with Maxwell equations. We don't start to calculate anything with this now in this course, but you should get an idea that Maxwell equation is a holy grail here. So they tell you everything. Everything can be derived from them, almost. So they tell how the magnetic field and electric field is related to each other and to the external charge also. But what is important to remember is that light is a wave, electromagnetic wave, and it propagates to one direction, and you have an electric field, which electric field is a red one, yes, which is perpendicular to the propagation direction, and then you have a magnetic field which is perpendicular to both of them. So there's this kind of a right-hand rule. If you're going in that direction, then your electric field is in that direction and the magnetic field is in that direction, always. And yeah, there was this wavelength also. Yes, now we come also to this wave-particle dualism. So light is also a particle, photon. So so far we have dealt light as a continuous wave. If we have a big enough object, this wave is just a ray. But if it goes smaller, then we have to think it as a wave. But if we go even smaller, we have to start thinking as a photon, which is kind of a particle with no mass. It's a packet of the wave. Wave packet is not a correct term here either, but it's kind of a piece of this kind of wave which travels. That's a photon. And here, some terms from optics or refractive index tells you the speed of your light. So C is a speed of light, so 300,000 kilometers per second, approximately. So basically, N tells how much your speed is decreased. Nothing can be faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, and vacuum N is 1. Yeah, so this is the speed of light, so phase velocity, if you are exactly correct. And then this N depends on the dielectric constant of your material. So this is kind of a relative permittivity, or dielectric constant is a more common used term, actually. I should have written it here, maybe. So this is electric response. And then you have a magnetic response, which is relative permeability. Usually you don't need to care about this. For every real material, this is very good approximation one. So usually people even forget it from this formula. So it's a square root of a dielectric constant, but it basically needs to be there. But then you have a frequency, which is always velocity divided by wavelength. Or frequency times wavelength is a velocity. This is common formula for any wave, not just light. And then you get the wavelength divided by wavelength in a vacuum by the refractive index. So it tells the speed, it tells the wavelength. But then you have a little bit more abstract term, which is a wave vector. And K is a kind of it's a kind of a momentum of your wave. So it's a direction where it travels. In this rule, what I just showed earlier, you have here direction of travel, so you can basically think it as a K vector. So this is your K vector, and this is your electric field vector, and this is your magnetic field vector, and they are always perpendicular to each other like this. Don't use left hand for that, then it goes wrong. And basically, then you have also wave number, which is just a absolute value of a K, no direction. And then comes a confusion. When you go to IR spectroscopy, This is plotted usually not function of a wavelength, but wave number. But for some reason, in the spectroscopy, which is originated from our chemistry, the wave number is 1/λ, not 2π/λ, which would be the physical correct way to define a. But it was just defined 1/λ by somebody. And it's a standard unit there. So there's two types of wave numbers. So you have to know which one you are talking about. There's a 2π difference. But now we keep 2π there because we talk wave vectors. Okay, then you can, if you do a little bit calculations, you can actually calculate expansion of a Snell's law, so Fresnel's equations, which tell you how the light is reflected and refracted. You don't need to remember these formulas, these are just to show. What you need to remember here is what is S polarized light and what is P polarized light. It's looked plotted here, the difference. And some terms here, which I might use later. So plane of incidence means the plane where the light comes and where it's reflected. They form this kind of plane. And now if your wave electric field is perpendicular to plane of incidence, so it's the same direction than your surface, then it's called S-polarized light. And if it's along in the plane of incidence and kind of not perpendicular, but not along the surface of where you reflect, then it's called P-polarized light. So basically S-polarization and P-polarization, these terms don't make any sense unless you have some surface where you reflect. But this is of course also where it only matters. If you have just a regular matter, it's usually just no matter what polarization you have, a behavior is similar. It only matters when you have a reflection or refraction. And this is defined as a P-polarized, and the S-polarized light is along the surface, the wave. This electromagnetic field is along the surface. If you want the demonstration of that, if you go to the boat and sail to the sunset, as in end of movie, and what you see reflection of a sun on the water. And mostly what you see is S-polarized light, because that reflects much more than the P-polarized light. That is directly visible from these formulas, maybe. Not so directly, but it is there. So S-polarized light reflects more. And now if you have sunglasses, so you have these fancy Ray-Bans, which are just like dark glass. Yeah, you see darker, but nothing else. But if you have these polarized glasses, they are made usually so that they only let vertical polarization through. And your reflection is, if you have a water, your reflection, S-polarized reflection is your electric field is horizontal. So they don't go through the glasses. So what you see is that if you put polarized glasses on, only the reflection on the water disappears. Others stay just a little bit more dimmer. So that's why always use polarized sunglasses on the boat. So they really matter. There's a funny thing called Fermat principle. It means that you can forget all other laws if you use this one. Which means that the path taken by ray between two given points is a path that can be traversed in the least time. So fastest road is the correct road. As you know, if you drive a car, fastest route is always the correct route. But it also applies to where is there. Yeah. So you can actually calculate this even here. Now you have a light. So what is a light coming to the, okay, let's, it's blue, it's water. Let's think it as a water surface. And your light is bending something like that. You don't know exactly. So now you have a, what is a time taken from point A to point B? A to B, and how much time? So you travel this distance b1 with some velocity 1. Then you plus the b2 divided by velocity 2. This is your total time. And now you have a formula. Well, speed of light, it's a C over the refractive index. So you can write it like that. I could draw it easily here, but actually I save some time and draw it here already. Unfortunately, in Finnish, because this was already done. So you have a distance divided by speed. So here, now we are in this formula. And that gives you the total time taken. And of course, the distance is depends what is the point here. So it depends on this x. And so you can write it as a function of x and then find the minimum of that function. Because the minimum of time is the correct path. If you derivate that, okay, so basically you know that if a function has a minimum, the derivative at the minimum is 0. So you take a derivative of a function and see where it is 0. And if you write this d1, yeah, you can use a Pythagoras here to write it like that and d2 like that. You can plug them in. You can take a derivative. So this is not one line calculation exactly. So that's why I didn't start to do it here. But if you take a derivative and write it down here and a little bit cancel some terms, what you end up is a Snell's law. So it is. You, everybody knows that Snell's law apply. So this gives the same law. So it works. Also same works if you start calculate lenses, how it focuses, this applies there also. So this is another way to explain behavior. And in quantum electrodynamics, it's kind of explained that the light goes all the paths. And then the total interference gives you answer. That is correct also. Okay, so that was a general photonics and ASM introduction, classical view mostly. Some applications. So there was some statistics where it's used mostly. Okay, if I see the colors correct. The biggest part here is kind of displays. And then is the information technology, another part. But it's used in many, many, many places. And as you can see from the numbers, it's kind of a big business. So it's just not a small industry, but it's really, and it has expanded a lot during last years. And one of the basic things in a photonics is kind of a liquid crystal display, LCD. So there's many versions of that in the market nowadays, which they market with the fancier name, the better. But they're all based on the same idea, which means that you have a light at the back. Then you have a polarizer, which means here you have a horizontal polarizer, which means that only the light with electric field horizontally. So electric field determines the polarization of a light. Nobody cares about magnetic field because it usually doesn't have any effect. So electric field then determines the polarization. So you have a horizontal polarization, then you have an electrode and liquid crystals, which means that you have this kind of, you have a liquid and you have a crystals, whatever. These are now these kind of beams. I don't know what these are, but let's draw them like that. These are crystals in a liquid, a liquid crystal. What happens? And then, okay, if they are like that, totally randomly oriented, nothing happened. Light goes through, it scatters a little bit, but it goes through as it is. And it was horizontally polarized here, then it goes through, and then comes another polarizer, which is vertical. So, but if you all your light is horizontally polarized, and then you put the vertical polarization, nothing goes through. Because there's no vertical polarized light anymore, because you have a, everything is horizontally polarized. So nothing goes through, and your pixel is black. But then you put voltage to this electrode, or between these two electrodes, you put voltage. Electrode, electrode, and then you put some voltage source here. So we get back to the electronic again. Electronics is everywhere. What happens to these crystals? They orient. No more randomly orient, but they orient along the electric field. And now what happens to the light going through? It actually changes the polarization. Okay, you cannot see this, how the orientation exactly does it, but you can calculate it. And if you have a correct kind of crystals, they change the polarization. So they turn your horizontal polarization to vertical, which then goes through this other polarizer. And then your pixel is bright. And it depends how much you put voltage, is how much these orient. It, and that determines how much it turns. So if your original polarization is horizontal, if you turn a little bit, then you would have half of the light through this vertical polarization. If you turn it fully, you get every light through it. So you can control the brightness of your pixel by that voltage. And then every pixel has its own electrode, which gives a voltage to that pixel. Actually, there's a free electrode, so you get colors. So there's a RGB, so red, green, and blue pixels, which you can light separately. So you need really tiny electrodes. And you need that nanofabrication, what we went 2 weeks ago to fabricate that. So this is one of most common, so this is still not nano. These are microns still. Other where this optics, photonics is used a lot is telecommunication. So you, nowadays all the internet is going in fibers, which means that you have a tube, N here much higher than the N in the surroundings. And now if a light travels inside here, it has total internal reflection happening everywhere, so it cannot escape. It just keeps going. It's a little bit simplified view, but basically it works like that. And usually this is actually not visible light, but usually it's something like infrared light, which you don't see. And what is nice, you can put hundreds of signals simultaneously at the different wavelengths. If you try to do that in electronics, you are in deep trouble separating these signals at the other end. But in a light case of light, that's easy. They don't interact. And what is actually goal nowadays, also all optical computers. Computers still use electronics. Because here, as I said, that you can put simultaneously hundreds of different wavelengths and they don't interact, so you can easily separate them. But if they don't interact, how you do all optical transistors? That would mean that you have a light coming here and you have other lights here controlling of how much light you go here. So that's an idea of transistor as we learned last lecture. But how would you do that in optics if the photons don't interact? So you have to do some tricks. So it doesn't work with just photons. Doesn't exist. So that's why there's no all optical computers. Okay, but can it go to nanometers? So this is also, last time I showed you some computer processors which has already tens of nanometer feature size, and 20 nanometer or so on. But we also talked about the diffraction limit. And I showed you this statue which resembles the Death Star. And that basically is a limit how small you can put light. So, but all optical computer has a, if nowadays you have a 6 million transistors in this small chip, because every transistor is 40 nanometer, now you need to put this transistor at least 200 nanometer. To fulfill the diffraction limits, if you would need all optics. And that would expand again size of your computer. Maybe it's more efficient, but then it's much, much bigger. So can we go to really nanoscale in the photonics? And this is actually plasmonics then. This is the way to go to nanoscale in the photonics. But we keep a break. This is a good time for a break. Yeah. 20 past. Okay.